Later when I saw the doctor who was on that ambulance waiting for this monk, and he told me that when he first saw that monk come off the train, he thought he would not get him to the hospital in time. He was deeply in shock, just really on the edge. But he got him to the hospital in time, he kept him going, and he survived, sort of, because he never really recovered his health. He was always sickly. And so we sent him to our monastery in England, thinking that in England you get better medical treatment. We gave him every medical treatment there was. And some of that medical treatment made him a tiny bit healthy, but nothing really worked. So what happened next? After 2 or 3 years of him being very sick, not really being getting recovered at all, the abbot of this monastery, Ajahn Sumedho, understood, had an insight, a Buddhist little piece of wisdom. And so he went up to the room, this attic in Chithurst Monastery in England, where this monk was lying on his bed, again feeling close to death. And he went up to that room, there was just the two of them in that room, and he said, "I've come up here on behalf of all of the other monks who live in this monastery, on behalf of the nuns, the laymen and the laywomen who support us. I've come up here on behalf of everybody to give you permission to die. You can die, it's all right. Don't try so hard to keep on living." And at that, this tough Rhodes Scholar from Oxford, wrestling champion from the United States, burst out crying. He wept and wept and wept and wept. And from that time on, he started to recover. And he's alive today. Not in great health, but, you know, reasonable health. It's a pretty amazing recovery. That monk, Ajahn Sumedho, saw the problem. He was trying so hard to get better, it was making him sick. It was stress. He was trying so hard not to die because he thought that was the worst thing he could do to his friends and loved ones, to die on them. That's why to this day, after that experience, when I counsel people who are dying, and that's part of my job also, I go up to them, first of all I ask them, when they're getting close to death, "Have you given yourself permission to die yet?" In other words, are you at peace with your impending death? And I try and encourage them to say, it's okay to die. There's nothing wrong with it. Be at peace with it. But secondly, that many people who are close to death keep telling me that they have given themselves permission to die, they're at peace with their impending death, but what causes them most trouble is their relations want them to live. And they cause the dying people so much suffering. They're ready to go, but their relations will not let them. "Mother, mother, please don't die. Please get better. Please get better." And so I tell the relations also, in your own way, in your own time, go up to the person who's dying and give them permission to die. I remember one of the times I did this, there was a young man, Steve his name was. He was only about 31, 32, again with cancer. It was inoperable. He was dying, he only had 1 or 2 days left. I went to visit him and his wife Jenny. And I told Jenny, I first of all talked to him, are you okay, are you ready to die? He said, "Yes, I am." And I told Jenny, "Have you given Stephen permission to go yet?" Because it was man and wife who still loved each other very deeply. And so it was a wonderful thing. I just stood back, and Jenny just crawled on the bed and held her husband and said, "Stephen, I give you permission to die." And they hugged and both cried. And it's a wonderful way for them to let go of each other. Really, remember what I said about unconditional loving kindness? The words of my own father, the door of my heart is open to you, no matter what you ever do, even if you die. Love is something which should liberate the people we love, which should free them. So I love you enough. I want you to be happy. I want you to be at peace. I give you, darling, my wife, my husband, or my little child, I give you permission to die. That's freeing that person. Even young people, it's all right to die. As Buddhism, we know it's according to past karma. Sometimes people die when they're old, sometimes people die when they're young. You know what the biggest problem, especially in the Western world, is when people die when they're young? They think that something's gone wrong again. Just when I started this talk, hands up if you've ever been sick, ever not been sick, sorry, and everyone had been sick. It's natural, it's not wrong to be sick. It's not wrong to die, even when you're young. I've known many children who've died from the time they've been born, 1 year old, 2 years old. Once there was one baby who'd been born only, and they tried to heal it, but after about 3 or 4 weeks it died. And so, I think it was a Hong Kong family. So they really wanted to do the very best for their child, but they just couldn't stand going to the funeral themselves. So they sent their child in a small box in one of these stretch limousines, you know, with two funeral directors in front. Because I was going to do the service, I had to sit in the back of that limousine as well. It was great fun when I came to the traffic lights. Because when you come to the traffic lights and you see a limousine, people are always looking to see who's inside. So these two, they look like chauffeurs in front. And they couldn't see the coffin because it was very low down on the seat. So I waved to them. Well, I have great fun. It's the only time I've been in a stretch limousine. But people die at all ages. And when I was a young monk, someone told me this story, because it's hard to understand the death of young ones. It's a very wonderful story, which again I tell at funerals when someone dies in their youth. There was a monk who was living in jungles in Thailand many years ago. He was living in a very simple hut made of bamboo and thatch. He'd been living in the jungle for many months. One evening there was a very powerful storm in that jungle. The rain lashed down, and worse than that, the winds were very fierce. They were so strong, they started to uproot trees. And he heard huge trees come crashing down to the ground around his hut. He admitted he was so scared he never slept all night. Because he knew if one tree just clipped his hut, there was no protection. It was just bamboo, that's all. As it happens, the storm abated in the early morning. He survived. So he went outside to see what damage had been done. Sure enough, some trees fell very, very close to his hut, but they'd all missed. He was very lucky. But then what took his attention were not the trees and the twigs, but what took his attention were the leaves, which had been torn from the trees the night before. As he would have expected, and you would expect, most of the trees torn off the twigs the night before were the old brown leaves. Leaves which had lived a full life on the trees and now lay dead, scattered on the forest floor. But amongst those old brown leaves, there were many yellow leaves, and also green leaves as well. And there were even a few very bright green leaves, which he knew would have only sprouted from the twigs, maybe 1 or 2 days at most. They too had been torn from the trees by the storm, and lay dead on the ground. But he wanted to check to see what leaves were left on the trees. And again, as you would expect, most of the leaves on the trees still alive were the green leaves. But even though young green leaves lay dead on the ground, there were still a few old brown curly leaves still clinging on. He realized that this is just like life. Young people die, where your old grandmother is still clinging on, old brown curled up leaf, she is. And he realized that this is nature, this is Dhamma. This nothing has gone wrong. This is the way things are. This is Dhamma. As in nature, so in the world of human beings. When the storms of illness and accidents rip through our community, they usually take the old people. But they also take many young people as well, even babies. And if ever you think that something's gone wrong, this shouldn't happen. Why does a young person have to die? It means you're not understanding the Dhamma. The Dhamma teaches us we could die at any time. Ajahn Chah always used to ask us, have you come here to die? Are you ready to die? Are you ready to die? Are you? How many people are there here today? I think some yesterday they said there's roughly about 300 people here, 150 people down here, 150 people up the top. 300 people in all. According to statistics, about six of you will be dead by the time I come here next year. Which six is it? And don't just look at the old people. When we understand death, it transforms our life. What it does when we know we're going to die, it means that we value life much more. Being at peace with death is accepting death happens, accepting it will happen at any time, just like the leaves on a tree. There's nothing wrong with death. We can give permission to ourselves to die and other people to die. If we've made a lot of good karma, we don't have to be afraid at all. We're going to have a lovely mansion with a golf course and Ferraris and everything there. So surely we should be at peace. But also, what that means, because we know we're going to die, we have to make the best use of the time we have. One of the other stories I tell at funerals. There's a friend of mine who lived in Sydney, who was a businessman. This businessman went for a medical checkup. A couple of days later, he got a call from his doctor at home. And the first thing his doctor said was, "Is your wife there?" From the tone of his voice and from that question, he knew that something was terribly wrong. "What's wrong?" he said to the doctor. He said, "Look, I'm sorry to have to say this, but the results have come back from the pathology lab. You've got a cancer, a bad cancer. It's very rare. It's very advanced. I'll give it to you straight. There's nothing we can do." And he said, "How long?" He said, "You can't tell in such cases. It could be 2 months, it could be 3 months, but it will never be 6 months. Please get your affairs in order." And this came like a shot out of the blue to this businessman. He felt so fit, he hadn't got any signs at all that cancer was happening, as is always the case. So he talked to his wife and his children. And he soon came to terms with the fact he was going to die soon. He'd always promised his family a trip to Europe, but he never had the time. Now, with only a few months left, he decided he was going to take that trip to Europe with his wife and children. He sold his business within a couple of days. He said it wasn't the best price you could get for a business, but it was actually quite good that he sold it so quickly. It was reasonable. And he bought first-class tickets. This was his last trip with his wife and children. He wanted to do it first class. When he had the tickets in his hand, he got another call from his doctor. It's a true story, it happened. The doctor was even more sort of concerned. He said, I don't know how to tell you this. There's been a mistake. Two people, same surname. You are perfectly healthy. Now, if that was the US, he'd probably sue that doctor. But that man called his doctor one of his greatest teachers. He's so grateful to that whole experience. He went on that trip to Europe with his family. He enjoyed himself so much. His family are important to him. He never realized how much until this happened. He had enough money back to get another business. He got a small cafe, you know, like they call it a truck stop, you know, where people traveling along the main highways would stop for petrol and for food. He's a great fellow. He said that experience changed his whole life. He realized that death can come at any time. Because of that, he valued every day. And what before was important, like getting rich, didn't matter so much anymore. His family, his spiritual life, that became so important. What death should do to us is remind us the importance of life. What are we here for? Is it just to become the richest person in the cemetery? To get the fanciest headstone? Or is it to make sure that we live this life so when it's time that we go, that we realize we've used our life wisely? We've enjoyed our life. We've also done charity work. We've served the community so that the world is a better place for us, not a worse place. We've made good karma. We've learnt about life, so we haven't wasted our time. And if you, when you die, can look at your life and say, yes, I've lived a good life. I've looked after my family. I've cared for the community. I've done charity. I've kept precepts. I've served. Then when you die, you will die with a very peaceful mind. And your friends and relations will think, what a wonderful performance that was, and how lucky I was to have known such a person. And that ends this talk on how to be at peace with sickness and death. Okay, very good. So I think we've got some questions I see passing around. I don't know how long these questions will take to answer because there's probably heaps of them. So we'll start as we go. So the first questions are, I'll just answer this. What made you decide to become a monk? Okay, when I was a young man, I think I told you I had a motorbike. I also had long hair as well. And my mother was always telling me to get my hair cut. So I did. She said that was not what I meant. No, the true story is that when I was as a school teacher, I just finished with a relationship with a girl. I wasn't born a monk. I was just an ordinary person going out with girls and other things. And I just finished a relationship. I'd heard in Thailand you can become a monk just for a short time, and at other places as well. So I decided just to become a monk for a couple of years because I thought that that would be a wonderful way to spend 1 or 2 years really dedicating it to my spiritual life. So actually I told some of the people in London, and my mother as well, I'd be back in a couple of years. But when I became a monk, actually straight away, it's very rare and it's very wonderful, I feel very privileged. I knew from the very start that this is what I always wanted to do. Because as a young man, I'd made a resolution. When you start thinking about your careers, what you're going to do in life, I decided that whatever I did in life had to fulfill two objectives. Firstly, it had to give me happiness. And secondly, it had to give happiness to others. I had to do something which served other people. Because I couldn't just be happy by myself. Now, I was a compassionate young man. So what actually happened was that as soon as I became a monk, I realized that as a monk, especially seeing someone like Ajahn Chah, just so happy, so at peace, that it gave you happiness. And when I saw how Ajahn Chah helped others more than any other person I'd ever seen, I realized that this was a way that I could serve the community. And now I got my happiness. I think you can see that. And also, by all of you coming here this evening, it means I'm fulfilling my second objective of giving happiness to others. What a wonderful life this is, to be a monk who gives happiness to others and has so much happiness themselves. And that's why I tell people, if you ever want to become a monk or a nun, I'll support you and encourage you in whatever way is possible. Because it's a wonderful lifestyle to have so much inner happiness and to be able to give happiness to others. That if you can just help one person overcome their grief because their husband or their wife dies, or overcome the fear of sickness, or overcome their depression, or become happier in their life, isn't that a wonderful service you give to others? So this is what a monk or a nun can do in society. We need more of them. So this is why I became a monk and why I'm so happy that I took that opportunity. For happiness of myself and to give happiness to others. What more can you want in life? What did you tell the couple at the funeral of their 20-year-old son to get them out of their grief? I think the main story was that story of my own father. Because, you know, I didn't just chant suttas. I talked from the heart what it meant to me when somebody died. And again, they felt so much loss that their 21-year-old son was not going to be with them anymore. But when I told them, look, you've had your son for 21 years. What a wonderful experience that was to have known such a boy for 21 years. It's like that you clap and shout for more, but eventually everyone has to go. It's never enough. But be grateful for the time you've had with him. Celebrate his life. Don't mourn his death. And they said, like others afterwards, they said they thought they were going to cry at his funeral. They came out feeling very strange. Not afraid, not grieving, but feeling inspired by the funeral. So that's what the main story which I told about the end of a concert. And when a young person dies before he or she is deprived of a chance to practice, isn't that a waste? Even children have a chance to practice generosity and kindness. 21 years of age, he practiced quite a lot. You know, we taught him meditation. He was keeping precepts. He was a good man. And it's not a waste because they always have another chance and another birth. So life is not wasted. Actually, I don't feel proud about it. It's not like just being egotistical, but I got one of the best pieces of praise once after a funeral when the funeral director came up to me afterwards. And he said to me, look, I listen to funerals every day. Usually 3 or 4 a day. And I've been doing this job for many years. And he said, but that was the best funeral I've ever heard. Thank you, he said. And that's actually getting praise from the professionals. Okay. Could you confirm the website which you mentioned in your talk yesterday, where we could hear your talks? Somebody has actually written it down for me, thank you. www.dhammaloka.org.au. We'll actually, I'll leave this out here if anyone wishes to see it, or you can put it on the board later on. Ajahn Dear. I'm not expensive. How does one grow rich emotionally in the Dhamma? Okay, by first of all having faith in the Dhamma. So I hope that my trip over here inspires you, that this Dhamma is full of precious jewels. That's why it's called the Triple Gem. And really, that if you actually dig into this Dhamma like you're digging into a mine, the more you dig out, the more jewels you find. So dig into this Dhamma, investigate it, read about it, listen to the tapes, and then start practicing it. And emotionally, in this Dhamma, don't be afraid of the beautiful emotions. Sometimes, this is another part of Dhamma I haven't talked about yet, sometimes people are afraid of attachments. Please know, in Buddhism, the Buddha never said all attachments are wrong and are leading to suffering. It's attachment to the bad things leads to suffering, or attachment to worldly things. You can attach to the beauty of charity as much as you like. It will lead to nibbana. You can attach to the happiness of keeping precepts. It will lead to nibbana. You can attach to the happiness of meditation. If you want to check this out, look in the Parsadika Sutta of the Digha Nikaya. The Buddha said that if you are attached to the joys of meditation, you use the word anuyoga, which literally means tied along with. If you're attached to the joys of meditation, you can expect four results, four benefits. Those four benefits of being attached to meditation, the happiness of meditation, are stream winning, once returning, non-returning, and full enlightenment. They lead to these things. So please know very clearly, the Buddha said it's okay to indulge in the pleasures of the noble emotions. If you're chanting to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, you get inspired with the piti sukha, with the joy of what the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha means to you, indulge in that emotion. Cry your eyes out. Recently, last February, March, I went to India to the holy places. My favorite place is always the Vulture's Peak. I don't know why, but twice I've been up there, twice I've cried. You know, a tough guy. I get very sort of emotional when I go up to Mount Vulture's Peak. And I know enough Dhamma to say, that is not attachment, that is not craving, that is just appreciating the wonderful emotions of a liberated being like the Buddha. So those emotions you get from practicing Dhamma, just indulge in them as much as you can. And that's how you grow rich in emotions. I was so relieved to see someone like Ajahn Chah, who was an enlightened being. I know in Penang someone said, how do you know he's enlightened? You have to live with someone to know someone's enlightened. And I lived with that monk for many years. So to see that someone who was enlightened was not just equanimous and just like a vegetable with a horizontal mouth all the time. He was inspiring because he was the happiest man I'd ever seen. Always on top of things, being able to laugh, being able to inspire, being able to smile. He was the richest man emotionally I've ever seen. So the arahat is not a dull person. The arahat is so emotionally rich, they've got immense loving kindness. And you feel so warm in their presence. It's like the grandfather. The best ideals of a grandfather you could ever have, who's just so warm and understanding, who will never sort of criticize you or hurt you or harm you in every way. And who is just so wise. And who can laugh with you. and could enjoy your presence and could be inspired with you in talking Dhamma. So that's how you grow rich emotionally in the Dhamma. I like the word rich because I was talking to the students today. They have something called the Forbes Rich List. I think it's at the Forbes 200, isn't it? Or Forbes 100? 500 now. Who is the richest person in the world now? No, it's not Bill Gates. No, it's not the Japanese. No, it's not the Walmart. The Forbes have got it wrong. You're getting close. Yeah, the monks. Aren't they the richest people in the world? The ones you've seen? What did the Buddha said? Contentment is the highest wealth. Not money. You look at Bill Gates. Say Dalai Lama. Who smiles the most? Who's the happiest? Who would you rather be? A happy person or a rich person? Now I see if you're really a Buddhist or not. There's one of the monks in Thailand, about 25 years ago. His parents were from Canada. They were very wealthy. Now that was when $1 million US was worth something. You know, about 10 times as much as it's probably worth now. He said no. It's marvelous to see that $1 million was nothing. He didn't, no hesitation at all. He'd rather be a monk than have $1 million. We're talking today about the Petronas Towers. You know, the owner of one of those anyway. His son is a monk in Ajahn Chah's monastery in Thailand. His name is Siripanya. He's the only son of a very wealthy man. He'd given it all up to be a monk. Why does he do that? He's much wealthier now than he was as a son of that rich man. If you gave me $1 billion, no way, I'd rather be a monk. So that's why you're rich emotionally in the Dhamma. Who wants $1 million anyway? It's just a burden. Bill Gates has got no time for himself at all. He works 7 days a week. Did he go on holiday? He hasn't got time. That's being very poor. Especially time-wise, he's very poor in his own personal time. As a single one has accumulated some assets, what are some suggestions for a good investment in the Dhamma? A good investment in the Dhamma is to throw it all away and become a monk. This is small investment, big returns. And stock markets go up and down, but the Dhamma always produces the goods. This is true. So with your assets, I mean, it really depends if you have the ability to become a monk or a nun. It's sometimes difficult to do because there's all sorts of, you know, entanglements which we have with life. So the best thing to do is investments in the Dhamma is look for communities like the, I'm not saying this because, you know, the BGF were once invited me today, but the BGF, see, they're active, they're actually doing something. So don't just give it to a temple just because of building this huge temple just for people to look at and be sightseeing. Give it to someone who's actually teaching the Dhamma, spreading the Dhamma, doing something good in the society. So you want to invest it where it's going to help the most people. So choose very carefully. But the best thing is just give it all away and just shave your hair. So certain people believe that there are ghosts and we are afraid of these beings. Should we be afraid? I hear you had a story about a nurse and a doctor inside a lift. Could you please share it with us? Thank you. That's one of the best ghost stories of the... And it's a true one, which happened in Thailand, in Sirirat Hospital, some years ago. If you want to be scared with a ghost story, this is one of the best. Now, first of all, I have to tell you that You know these strings which people wear around their wrists? You've got some strings over there. That in Thailand, they only give white strings to wear around your wrists, because red strings are only put around people's wrists in Thailand when they're dead. Red. Now that's just their, there's nothing special about that. It's not bad luck or anything, it's just their custom. So anyway, early one morning, there was a doctor in Surivad Hospital who was going to work. He was in a lift, in the elevator, with a nurse was with him, the witness. And as it stopped on one of the floors and the doors opened, there was a man standing in front of the lift waiting to get in. As soon as the doctor saw this, he went white. And he reached for the close button as soon as he could, and he closed that button so the lift doors closed before this man came in. And the nurse was surprised, saying, "What did you do that for?" And he said, "Didn't you see that red string on that man's wrist? He was my patient. He died yesterday. That was a ghost." And this poor doctor was terrified. He actually saw one of his patients there, and so did the nurse. But then what the nurse said, he said, "That's really strange, because I've got a red string around my wrist as well." And it was a true story, because actually that doctor, he was found unconscious on that lift. And when he came to, he related the story. It was a true story. It actually happened. And they found out that when he came to and he described that nurse, she died in a road accident on the way to hospital. It was a real ghost. And the poor man had one outside and one inside. But the point is that the ghosts are never hurt anybody. So, because ghosts never hurt anybody, you don't need to be afraid of them. So that if you do ever see a ghost, this is a ghost around, don't get afraid of them. Just give them loving kindness. Sort of do some merits for them, and then they'll just go away. So all those ghosts, we've got lots of ghosts, so we collect them as monks, because people come and tell us their ghost stories, and it's fascinating. But if you really want to hear some ghost stories, if you go to the Brickfields, because the last time I was here I gave a whole talk on ghosts. Even the Chief of Evans got one of the really brilliant ghost stories. He said that somewhere in KL that there was a ghost messing around in somebody's house, so they actually called the Christians first of all and the Muslims. It didn't work. If you have a ghost, the Buddhists are the best. So they called him and a few other monks. They did some chanting. It worked. So the house was peaceful afterwards. But a few days later, the neighbours came to complain. Because the ghost had got in their house instead. So he had to go charging to all the houses around to get rid of this ghost. He just pushed into someone else's house. You know the worst ghost in our society, and actually this is the dangerous ghost, this one can actually hurt you. It's called the bottle ghost. The bottle ghost. Now if anyone is afraid of ghosts, please warn them, the bottle ghost, because these bottle ghosts, they take over your mind. They possess you and you do some crazy things. They even cause deaths. People have crashed their cars because of the bottle ghost. Alcohol. You open up the lid of the bottle and a bottle ghost takes over your mind. And that's one ghost which everyone has seen, which is real. And the bottle ghost is the only dangerous one. It lives in a bottle of alcohol, so don't open the lid, it might catch you out. How about if our society is sick, unaware of human rights or press freedom? Should we just sit back and let go, or we should step out? Okay. The thing to do, if there's something you can do, then do it. If there's nothing you can do, then you can't do it. You have to wait for the opportunity. Remember what I said last night about the soldier in the British Army? I told that story, didn't I? About letting go? Cup of tea, yes, right, yeah. Because when they were surrounded by enemy troops, instead of trying to fight his way out, we just killed everybody. When there was nothing to do, he kept his energy, had a cup of tea, and waited until there was something he could do effectively. Now, if society is sick or whatever, there's something to do in the world, sometimes if you really feel that there's nothing you can effectively do, you have to bide your time and wait until you can be effective. That's the only thing you can do in life, in politics, in society, or whatever. Too many people just waste their energies trying to fight battles they can never win. So stand back and be slow and be gentle about these things, because sometimes, we're sort of too impatient. And sometimes we can take it, sometimes it's our karma to be restricted in these ways. So see if we can just be gentle with our approach, be kind. And now really, as far as Malaysia is concerned, Buddhism and Islam, if Buddhism is really practiced properly in this country, and people are very tolerant and wise and kind, that's going to impress a lot of people. I think that's going to really create the tolerance from other people in the community towards the Buddhists. Just the quality of Buddhist people in Malaysia. And it's going to happen naturally without being forced. Now, all people, they revere saints. If someone is living a saintly, good life, they're going to be respected. So that's my feeling anyway. People might object to me, but if there's something you can do, do it. But don't go into extremes where you're just going to get into trouble and create more difficulty for everybody else. Just know your limits and work within them. Is there any way to guide ourselves towards Buddhism once more when we're reborn again? Thank you. It's when we get reborn again that even though often we cannot remember the details of our past lives, we retain the inclinations from our previous lives. Like, why was I a Buddhist? I said I went to a bookshop and read a book, but why did I pick that book in the first place? It's obvious to me that it's not the first time I've been a Buddhist monk. That's quite obvious now. I've been a Buddhist many lives, especially a monk. And that's why if ever you have a child, and it's a boy, if it's born without any hair, bald, that's a sign it's going to be a Buddhist monk. And anyway, there's a past life story, which I'm going to talk about now. One of the Buddhists in Sydney, who an Australian Buddhist, his auntie was reborn as his daughter. Now, this is actually what happened. His auntie was a very successful businesswoman, like a multimillionaire in Sydney. But like many of the such businesswomen, that she was, she never liked giving any money to charity, and especially she didn't like giving any money to the government. She'd do whatever she could not to pay taxes. And when she was close to death, she made out her will to her relations. Being her nephew, he was included in the will. But because he was a Buddhist, he was the only person in the family who was at all religious, she gave him such a small amount because she was afraid that he'd give his money away to Buddhist charities. And she didn't like that at all. So that when she died, very soon afterwards, his wife gave birth to a child, and all the relations remarked on how it looked like their auntie. This woman who died, even physically, it looked like her. Once a baby started to talk, the memories just came back. One of the things he did inherit from her was just some of the crockery, the mugs. He came into the room one day with a cup of coffee, and this little baby went berserk. "My mug! Daddy, give me my mug! That's my mug!" When they went past her house, the old mansion, "Daddy, my mansion! Take me to my mansion!" The recall was often and very clear that the whole family were convinced that that was that auntie of his, who had now been reborn as his daughter. The effect of karma, number one, because she was so stingy and she didn't give any money to her nephew, now that was her father and she had to live in poverty now. But number two, and the point of this story, that one day, he told me this, it was a fascinating little anecdote. They were driving along the freeway, or the tollway in Sydney, motorway I think it's called, and they saw one of these big billboards by the government mentioning tax. And this little 2 or 3 year old said, "Daddy, what does the word tax mean?" And Daddy explained very patiently that when you get any money and you earn some money, you have to give some of it to the government. And straight away this 2 or 3 year old said, "Daddy, whenever I get any money, I'm giving nothing to the government." And for a 2 or 3 year old to say such thing was just unprecedented. What had happened is that her tendencies from the previous life had carried over into this life, and even though she didn't know why, even as a 3 year old, she would hate paying tax. Now that's the inclinations. That's actually what does go over from life to life. And those inclinations, if you've been a Buddhist in this life and enjoyed being a Buddhist and got great benefits from being a Buddhist, you don't have to worry about how you're going to find Buddhism in the next life. You will do. You'll incline towards that. Even if you're born into a family in London, you'll eventually find some bookshop and you'll get a book in Buddhism. So that's actually how it works. Ajahn, is there such a belief that we can speak to the dead person, i.e. converse with the soul? Does a person rebirth immediately upon death? Why do the Chinese believe that the soul is still around within the 7-day period? Okay. When a person dies, so often they linger around for a while before they go to their rebirth. I'm talking about this today. Out-of-the-body experiences have been scientifically shown to be true. Read Dr. Moody's work. He was a doctor in one of these hospitals in the US. It was a multicultural hospital. People of all races and religions would go to this hospital for treatment. He had heard of the out-of-the-body experiences. He wanted to put it on a sound scientific basis. So every patient in that hospital, no matter what race, religion or gender, or age, died on the operating table and was resuscitated. Anyone who was clinically dead for a short period of time but lived afterwards, he gave a questionnaire to, in confidence afterwards. Most people don't tell about their out-of-the-body experiences because they're afraid they'll be laughed at. So in confidence, he gave them some questions, not leading questions, but just to see if they had any memories in the time they were dead. And he found that there was a standard a standard thing which happened after death, and people had usually one or more of these experiences. Firstly, floating out of your body, being able to look down and see your body lying on the table and the doctors operating, be able to see and hear everything. Number two, floating towards a light and going through that light. Number three, it's being told that it wasn't your time, or, you know, it wasn't proper that you were going to die now. But number four, going back into the body and feeling the pain of the body before you were unconscious. Just classical symptoms, symptoms of out-of-the-body experiences. Some people had all those experiences, some only one or two. But most had something. And that's exactly what happens when a person dies. That's part of Buddhism. It's called the Manomaya Kaya. mind-made body. Many examples. The one I told this afternoon was a very funny story, because did I tell that yesterday about the English lady who had a... Only today, this afternoon. Okay, I'll tell it again here for you. This English lady was a very wealthy lady, and she had a very expensive specialist. And when you pay a doctor a lot of money, he's usually very polite to you. And this English doctor was extremely polite. The operation she undergone was just an ordinary operation, but there were complications. Something went wrong, she died on the operating table, but was later revived. Now, what happened while she died was the doctors and the nurses, they panicked. They were trying everything to get this woman back to life again. And so the doctor, forgetting himself, said, "Don't give up on me now, you bitch." Please excuse me, that's what he said. "Don't give up on me now, you bitch." He didn't realize that she was listening at the time. So when he had the first post-op meeting with her, she went to her bedside. He said in a very polite English voice, "Madam, we came jolly close to losing you that time." She looked him in the eye and said, "Yes, but why did you call me a bitch?" And his poor doctor was completely astounded, and he said, "How on earth did you know that? You were dead at the time." And she explained what had happened, and she explained the operation and what went wrong and what the doctor was doing. And the doctor was amazed that the only way you could see such things, because you know in operation people are just all around the table, the only vantage point where you can see such things is literally floating up above looking down. And that convinced that doctor that out-of-the-body experiences aren't just imagination, not fantasy, they're real. If that's what happens when a person dies temporarily and they come back to tell the tale, that's pretty strong evidence that that's what happens when a person actually dies. So because that's so well known, and that's actually where ghosts happen, this is another true ghost. This is a real ghost story, not sort of one of these frightening ones. One of my devotees in Perth is an Englishman. Name is Peter. He's migrated to Australia a long time ago. One night, in his house, very close to our city temple, he woke in the middle of the night. At the end of his bed was his mother. He had the bedside lamp on. He saw her as clear as you're seeing just an ordinary person. He knew straight away, because his mother lived in Essex in England, he knew straight away what had happened. His mother had died. He knew it was a ghost. But he said the strangest thing was, in those 2 minutes they were looking at each other, he never felt any fear at all. He knew it was a ghost, but it was his mother smiling at him. He hadn't seen her for so long. And he felt so happy, so at peace, that he was looking at his mother again. And she was smiling. And before his eyes, she just faded away after 2 minutes. And he felt again so much peace. His mother had died and he'd seen her at the very end. So being an Englishman, once she disappeared, he got up and made a cup of tea. And as he was drinking his tea, the telephone rang. It was his sister from England. He said, "Pete, I've got some bad news." "Yes," he said, interrupting her, "Mum's died." "How on earth did you know that?" said his sister. And he explained how his mother had appeared to him. And that's such a wonderful, cherished experience, that he could see his mother just as she died, and to see her smiling and at peace, that made all the difference to him. And that's what real ghost stories are like. They're usually very beautiful and very wonderful. And because of that... Actually, wouldn't you be happy if that was your mother and she was, say, in the US or somewhere on a holiday and she died and you actually saw her smiling at you? You're not afraid of her in real life. As a ghost, you feel just so wonderful, so peaceful, so lucky to see her before she disappears forever. He said that was one of the most wonderful experiences. So because that is actually real, when a person dies, And when you go to their funeral, very often they can hear everything which is being said at a funeral. They also know who goes to their funeral. And because of that, that my job as a monk is actually to spread loving kindness and share merits with a person who's died. Even if they're a good person, you can always sort of bump up their merits. I call it like upgrading their airline ticket. So because of that, you can always speak to them. And one of the things which I also do at funeral services, which is a very beautiful thing, very often when somebody dies, especially suddenly, there's always unfinished business. Sometimes we feel very guilty because there's something we've said and or done, or more often something we haven't said and done, which we should have done to our mother or our father. And now they're dead. We think that we can't say sorry or we can't say how much we love them. I was like that with my own father. I loved that man very much, but I was only 16. I didn't know how to tell him I loved him. I realized afterwards, you can always say that to your parents once they're dead. So nowadays, when at a funeral, I always involve a forgiveness ceremony. I tell everyone to shut their eyes, close their eyes. And I say, think of the one who's passed away, who's dead, who's in the coffin in front of you. And from your heart say, if there's anything I've done by body, speech or mind, which I shouldn't have done, intentional or unintentional, which might have hurt or irritated you, or made you upset, or if there's anything I didn't do, which I should have done, I sincerely ask your forgiveness. You're my mother, my father, but I really love you and I respect you. I've got so much gratitude for all you've done to me. Sincerely, I ask your forgiveness. And you imagine that person, just make your mind peaceful, and they would give you that forgiveness, as your mother and father would do in real life. When people go through that ceremony, even like Westerners who are not Buddhists, they find that one of the most important parts of the funeral ceremony. Because there's always something we've done or not done which upsets us. And that person, once they're dead, they can hear that. They know what's going on. And it makes all the difference to them. They know this sorry has been said. And it means all the past bad karma has been left behind. So they can go off to their new life, not burdened with bad memories. And you can let them go as well, not burdened with bad memories. And just celebrating all the good qualities and the good time you've had together. Yes, you can talk to such a person. Once they're dead, 7 days in most Chinese tradition, any time, it's 49 days. There's evidence of that, that in my monastery in Thailand, one of the devotees died, performed their funeral service. Sometime later, their father came to the monastery. The father was the treasurer of the monastery. He came one morning very early. He was very upset. Not upset, but very disturbed. Because he said that that morning at breakfast, there was about 10 people in this house, that one of them at breakfast had said they dreamt of this girl who died. And this girl had come to one of his daughters, and said, I've been around long enough, now I'm going to take leave, I ask permission to go. And when she recounted this dream, everyone else fell silent in this house. There's about 9 or 10 people in this house. And one by one, they all recounted they had the same dream. That night, this girl who had died some time before had come to each one of them in their dream and said, I've been here long enough now. It's time for me to go. I've come to take my leave. And the coincidence was just too strange. He came to the monastery. What's going on? Because I was at the funeral, I knew this lady. I knew the day she died. I looked at the calendar. I counted 49 days. Not 50, not 48. 49 days. This lady had stayed before she left. So that's why if you want to make merit and share merits with someone who's died, they can always and just nearly always be reached within 49 days. Afterwards, if they stay in the ghost realm, they can be, continue to be reached. Otherwise, basically they're gone to their new life. So, next question is, what is a typical funeral program, if any, of your funeral services? Do you think it is suitable for, is it Aryan funerals, or what does that say? Don't know. Okay, you can't read it either. Suitable for maybe other funerals. It's that funeral service what I did is basically suitable for any funerals. Sometimes I have done it for Christians because they like the sort of the feeling of the funeral service of doing like some teachings so people understand death, giving some stories, doing an act of forgiveness and an act of letting go so the person can be let go of. How do you counsel young children who are terminally ill? Young children are great when they're terminally ill. They accept things because they haven't learned that death is wrong. Sometimes at funeral services, I look at young children. When they go into the funeral service, they're confused. They don't know what to do. And if they see their mother and father crying their eyes out, then they cry too. They learn grief as a conditioned response to being at a funeral service. If you leave those children alone to act naturally, they'll accept death and they won't be upset about it. A lot of children who are terminally ill, they accept it very easily. Reverend Sir, I'm a registered organ donor. I would like to know whether it is okay for the donor to remove my organs once my heart stops beating and I'm certified dead. Yeah, there's a few people ask me this question. To be an organ donor is a wonderful thing to do. It's only when when you are medically dead, do you leave your body and out-of-the-body experiences? Apparently, this is one of the things they found out, that if you are medically still alive, you don't leave your body. Once you're medically dead, you do. So once you're termed medically dead, you've already left your body, so they can take your organs, you won't feel anything, you don't need them anymore. And it's wonderfully good karma. I've signed all the forms to donate all my organs. So if I die in Malaysia, you can have whatever you want. Suppose that I donate my brain. And suppose that Dr. Wee gets my brain. Ben's son committed suicide 3 years ago. Till today, she cannot accept his death. What would be your advice to her? Is to say that your friend's son, so if you knew him for so many years, be grateful that he came into your life for so long. What love is to say the door of my heart's open to you no matter what you've ever done. Even if you commit suicide, I will still love you. It may have been a stupid thing to do, but that's not a stupid person. Don't judge a person by one act they did, even if it's a very severe act like a suicide. In the same way I've said that a person who drops the sauce jar on the supermarket floor, never say that you're a stupid child. Say it's a stupid thing you've done. It was probably a stupid thing to do that you committed suicide, but who knows? I can't judge people. You don't know what that person was going through when they decided to take their life. So forgive, because forgiveness is part of love. If you really love your son, you'll be able to accept whatever he does. The door to my heart is open to you, son, no matter what you've done, even if you committed suicide. My love for you still remains. If she hasn't accepted that, that's called hate. You're hating the act, you're hating the person. May all beings be happy and well, even my son who committed suicide. Loving kindness forgives. Okay, it's only in brief because I'm going over time this evening. It's 20 past. So, we finish off now. Thanks for coming. We'll maybe do the sharing of merits first and then have the announcements. Okay, we'll do the sharing of merits now. Idam men yati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo Idam me yatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me yatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.